This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Don't look now, but this economy? Oh, it's changing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 31st day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hey, so did you feel that? It was kind of subtle. You had to be paying attention to pick up on it, but it definitely has been happening. It's a change, a shift, if you will, in what we, the notoriously fickle but completely essential American consumer, have been doing. You remember during the worst of the pandemic when we really couldn't go anywhere? We just bought lots of stuff instead. That stressed out all of our supply chains, helped drive inflation as well, but over the past couple of weeks, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, the giant economic pendulum at the heart of this economy, that would be us, consumers, it's been swinging back towards spending on services. Here you go.
Earlier in the pandemic, consumers across America swerved towards goods.
During the pandemic, I got a house.
That's George Hinchliff, an IT worker in Seattle. He's been slowly filling that house with stuff.
Mainly furniture.
By the spring of 2021, the U.S. was consuming a third more durable goods than it had been just before the pandemic.
And that put enormous strains on the system.
Phil Levy is chief economist at Flexport. He says spending is starting to change, especially with non-durable goods, the perishable stuff you don't keep for long.
Non-durables have started to behave a little bit more like they did pre-pandemic.
But durable goods, the big ticket items, the ACs, the refrigerators, the furniture,
durables demand is still looking strong and continuing.
Meanwhile, people want to get outside and do stuff, not just buy stuff. Air travel bookings surged earlier in the year, according to Adobe Digital Insights. Consumers are finally spending as much on services as they did pre-pandemic, according to Kathy Bostjancic, chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics.
For now, consumers are still spending on goods, but they're also spending more on services, right, relative to what they were spending previously.
Theoretically, less demand for stuff and more demand for services should help with everything from supply chains to inflation, but there's a but.
It takes some of the heat off of goods prices, but it does help to fuel higher service prices.
Exhibit A, flights. George Hinchliff traveled from Seattle to North Carolina for his grandma's birthday.
I've literally paid more for this flight than I've paid for international long-haul flights to other countries.
Oxford Economics' Bostjancic says this rebalancing between goods and services in the American economy is just getting started. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Among the services that are expected to see a big surge in demand, especially come summertime, we're talking tourism and restaurants, recreation too, businesses in those sectors are scrambling to fill seasonal jobs. Well, really, those industries have been scrambling to fill jobs all year round, right? We've covered that. But the consumer pendulum swinging like Sabri was talking about means it is going to be another big season this summer for teenage workers. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that.
The sing-alongs with s'mores are back in full force this year, says Tom Rosenberg at the American Camp Association.
This summer, we need all of these young adults. We need them all to help come and work for a summer camp, have a great time, learn.
He says camps started recruiting last fall, but still have about 1,800 positions to fill. In the Columbus, Ohio suburb of Hilliard, Anastasia Bradley is searching for dozens of lifeguards to staff community pools.
We went out to almost all of the high schools and took some treats with us that had a sticker with a QR code on it that led directly to the application. We have actually offered open interviews, which we have never done before.
The American Lifeguard Association warns that a third of public pools could remain closed this summer due to staffing shortages. Teens are looking for work, says Julia Pollack, a labor economist at the job site ZipRecruiter. But many have taken better-paying, full-time jobs that once went to more experienced candidates.
Many teenagers have seen their friends get the kinds of jobs that are allowing them to buy a car within the first month, and so their expectations have been raised.
Quit rates are still high, and labor force participation is down among pretty much all age groups except teens, says Liz Wilkie, economist for HR platform Gusto.
What's happening as a result is that the share of hiring for the summer that's being taken up by teen employment has been increasing year over year, and we're really seeing it start to spike now.
Wilkie says since 2018, teens have gone from 2 to 10% of all summer hires across industries. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
President Biden had a chat with Fed Chair Jay Powell today. Inflation, of course, was the agenda. That's it. That's the news. The White House seemed to be doing something about the economy. Wall Street today, it could have been worse. Details, numbers, you know the drill. From the Marketplace desk of really cumbersome economic indicator names comes this today. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index was out this morning. Nationally, home prices in this economy were up 20.6% in March over a year ago. 20.6%. Tampa knocked Phoenix out of the top spot for biggest price jump. 35% increases there. And yes, I can hear you now saying, you know, Kyle, you warned us the other day about lagging indicators. And sure, Case-Shiller is that, lagging. And there are signs demand is cooling, just like Jay Powell wants. But there is something else keeping home prices high, you know. Nobody is putting their houses up for sale anymore. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Back in early 2020, Becky Repka was ready to downsize. Her four-bed, two-bath home in Sacramento felt too big for just her and her teenage son.
Well, I was just about ready to list it. We'd gotten, honestly, everything cleared out and cleaned up and the photos taken.
Then COVID hit and Repka hit the pause button. Now her home is worth more than $100,000 more than it was 2 years ago. But so are many of the smaller places she would move into. So for now, she's staying put.
And honestly, even considering what my other options might be, do I build out some sort of mother-in-law quarter that I could rent out?
On a typical day in April 2019, there were about 1.2 million homes up for sale. Last month, that number was 409,000. Economist Danielle Hale with Realtor.com says there's a chicken and egg problem. Would-be home sellers don't want to be would-be home buyers right now.
So when the market is ultra competitive, that is impacting their calculation on whether or not it's a good time to sell.
And since refinancing your home at record low interest rates was as much of a pandemic pastime as baking your own sourdough,
that raises the cost for them if they're thinking about moving, not just because of higher prices, but because they're also likely to see a higher mortgage rate.
There's other factors. Institutional investors with single-family rentals may be less likely to sell. But Zillow economist Nicole Bichot says the main problem behind lack of inventory is one you've probably heard before.
We go back to the end of the Great Recession. Home builders stopped building at the level that they were previously and didn't pick back up until about 2021.
Bichot says it'll take a while to build ourselves out of the shortage we're in now. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
There is no easy way to make a turn from housing inventory to gun violence, especially on a day when the first victims of the murders in Uvalde are being laid to rest. But as I said a couple of times last week, gun violence in America is an economic story. It's a business story, and it's a money story. Traditionally, leading causes of death in this country get lots of funding for research so that we can understand how to stop or at least reduce those causes of death. Think cancer or even the pandemic, right? But gun violence is a different story with a very complicated history. We've gotten John Woodrow Cox on the phone to explain. He's an enterprise reporter at The Washington Post, also the author of a book called Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give us the quick background on the Dickey Amendment, please?
Yes. So in the mid-1990s, the NRA recognized after a CDC study came out that basically said that the presence of a gun in a home made people more likely to die. The NRA went nuts over it. They were furious and said that the government should not be pushing gun control. So they convinced a lawmaker from Arkansas to propose an amendment in a budget that said the CDC, the U.S. government researchers were not allowed to push gun control. That's the sort of the short version of it. And it created a chilling effect that lasted for more than two decades, in which there was virtually no funding for government research of gun control. It would be the analogy that I use is in the early stages of the pandemic, if a lawmaker, a single lawmaker, had come out and said, you know, vaccines are just too political, we're not going to study how to fix COVID. It would be the same thing. This was in the 90s when there were enormous numbers of shootings all over the country, and we simply stopped researching gun violence. It's a thing that has set us back decades.
Be more explicit for me. Why and how has that pause on research into gun violence, because as we'll get to in a minute, there is now some more funding for gun violence research.
Yes.
But we took 20-ish years in this country and just didn't study that. What's the causal? How did that manifest in gun policy?
Yes. So all sorts of solutions would have been surfaced through that research. And we know that because if we look at something like vehicle safety, you know, in Jay Dickey's case, he switched sides on this issue and he actually became a fierce advocate for research. And he regretted what was the defining moment of his political career for the rest of his life. And what convinced him were the little 3-foot barriers on the highway. Mm-hmm. And he realized that a researcher had figured out that if they just put a concrete barrier between the lanes, that it would save hundreds of thousands of people's lives. That is what we could do with guns, whether it's smart guns or how red flag laws should work or things that we haven't even considered. We would know those things. You know, RAND did this huge review of available research to see which policies actually work and which ones don't. And what they found overwhelmingly was there's not enough evidence to conclusively decide what works and what doesn't work because there just isn't enough research. But it was intentional. It was intentional designed ignorance.
Jay Dickey, of course, is the Arkansas lawmaker whose name became attached to that amendment. I guess the question now is, Congress, having seen perhaps the error of its ways in not studying gun violence and gun violence research, has decided to allocate more money. Where are we on gun violence research right now?
Very early, very early. I mean, the one thing that was encouraging is this happened before the change in administration. The money was actually allocated when President Trump was still in office, which is very encouraging because it would imply that when a Republican takes office again, that they'll continue to study it. But the money to this point has been symbolic. You know, I get into this in a great deal in my book, where I actually break down the amount of money we should be spending for something that kills 40,000 plus people a year. You know, we're in the tens of millions, like 25, 50 million. That tends to be what the numbers are.
I've never said this before on Marketplace, but I want you to get into the weeds of how much money we should be spending, because this analysis you did was fascinating.
hundreds of millions. We should be spending hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, it is in the infinitesimal percentage points, because there was actually research done on, okay, the dollar spent per death caused by, you know, whatever the issue is. And it was the least studied among causes of death.
Do you think it's possible to make up for lost time? I mean, we lost 20-something years of research into this.
So no, we can't make up for the time we've lost. But, you know, it's the cliche of better late than never, right? I mean, we're never going to get to zero. In our lifetimes, in no lifetime, will America get to zero gun deaths a year, or even close. But we could go from 45 to 35 or 30 or 25. That's worth it. Those sort of incremental steps are worth it. And that is what research could very quickly tell us.
John Woodrow Cox is an enterprise reporter at the Washington Post, also, which I'm sure is the reason his phone is ringing off the hook these days. He's the author of a book called Children Under Fire, an American Crisis. It's about the effects of gun violence on the kids in this country. John, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
Too many eggs in too few baskets problem.
Gotta spread it out, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 222 points today, 2/3%, 32,990. The NASDAQ down 49 points, about 4/10%, 12,081. S&P 500 down 26, about 6/10%, 41,032 there. Just shy of $296,000 a year. That's the median worker salary at Google's parent company, Alphabet, last year. It's according to a Wall Street Journal data analysis, 14% higher than before the pandemic. About half of the top 25 median salaries were at tech firms. Lowest median worker salary in that survey, $7,400 a year at an auto parts firm called Aptiv, which told the Journal that salary went to a full-time worker, hourly worker, by the way, in Mexico. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It has been a busy couple of days for the European Union. The bloc
has announced it's going to do without about two-thirds of its imports of Russian oil. Crude, it should be said, that comes by sea only is subject to this embargo. They had to keep the pipelines open to get Hungary to go along. Ukraine, of course, has been pushing for a complete ban, and Kyiv has called the sanctions too little too late. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more on this one from the European desk in London.
Since the invasion of Ukraine began, the EU has reportedly poured more than $2 billion a week into the Kremlin's coffers in payment for Russian oil. Ukraine called for a complete ban on these imports. In his Twitter feed, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba had made his feelings clear.
If there is any country in Europe who will continue to oppose the embargo on Russian oil, this country is complicit in the crimes committed by Russia in the territory of Ukraine.
But Hungary doggedly blocked a total embargo, primarily, says Ian Bond of the Centre for European Reform, for economic reasons.
Hungary is very dependent on Russian oil, and its refinery is configured to deal with Russian crude.
And, says Bond, Hungary's right-wing leader Viktor Orban had another, less respectable reason for going easier on the Kremlin.
You know, he's made no secret of his admiration for the strongman approach that Putin takes.
The Ukrainians accuse the EU of strengthening Putin's hand by not imposing a total oil embargo. And they have other worries. They say the French have been privately urging them to make concessions so that Putin can save face and end the war. There's little doubt, says Nick Redman of Oxford Analytica, concerns are growing across the EU about the war's economic repercussions.
In France and in Italy and in Germany, a sense has developed in the past sort of couple of weeks that given the European cost of living crisis, an extended conflict is just too damaging.
This may explain why Germany, according to German press reports, has not delivered, as promised, any heavy weapons to Ukraine since the end of April. Is European resolve to defeat Putin waning?
I'm not sure we can say waning yet. It's certainly having a wobble at the moment.
The EU insists that its ban on two-thirds of Russian oil imports will hit the Kremlin hard, and that due to separate German and Polish pledges, 90% of those imports will be blocked by the end of the year. But as they lose ground to the Russian invaders, the Ukrainians clearly feel that European support is beginning to soften. At the European desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We have all, through the course of this pandemic, learned way more than we ever thought we would about global supply chains. Where they have been stuck, think, for instance, the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Why they've been stuck, think pent-up demand and recently the lockdowns in China. And increasingly, which products have been most affected? PPE early on, right? But also computer chips. And now something called IV contrast dye. It's used in CT scans and some other medical procedures, and it is in extremely short supply right now. GE Healthcare is one of the main suppliers, and its main plant near Shanghai has been turning out a lot less of the stuff for weeks now. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that story.
Aaron Dwyer needs a CT scan.
I had a sonogram, and they found a growth on my right kidney.
Dwyer is a graphic designer in Northern California. She's got two little kids, and she's trying not to stress too much about the growth.
But every now and then, the worry just sort of slams into me. I think with little kids, you can't help but start to like catastrophize.
The only way to find out what's going on is to get a CT with contrast dye. But when she tried to schedule it in early May, the woman she spoke to told her they didn't have anything until June.
She said, you know, there's actually this shortage of contrast dye, and so we're having to schedule appointments way further out than we normally do.
Hospitals all around the country are having to put patients off like that.
We were told that we will now, for an undetermined period of time, have only 20% of the supply of IV contrast that we're used to receiving.
Dr. Joshua Cooper is with the Temple University Health System.
And that, of course, means that we're going to have to ration, which is a terrible word to have to use in healthcare, but that's truly what we're going to have to do.
IV contrast dye is a liquid that gets injected into your veins to make your organs and blood vessels much easier to see on a CT or an X-ray. Nancy Foster at the American Hospital Association says it's critical in all sorts of scans and procedures.
If you present in an emergency room with the symptoms of a stroke or some kinds of heart disease, we will likely do a scan on your heart or your brain.
If you're getting a stent, they might use dye to see your arteries better. And Foster says for many cancer patients,
it's used quite frequently to monitor tumors that are being treated.
Foster says about half of hospitals get most or all of their IV contrast dye from GE, and they're now having to find ways to stretch what little they have. They can do some scans and procedures without it, and sometimes they can do MRIs or ultrasounds instead of CT scans. Dr. Matthew Davenport at the American College of Radiology says many hospitals are doing all of that in addition to delaying scans.
The goal here is to make sure that the place doesn't run out completely, because if they do, then they won't have any contrast left to do those necessary scans.
GE Healthcare declined to talk for this story, but Davenport says the company is telling hospitals it expects supplies to start getting back to normal by the end of June. Meanwhile, hospitals are thinking about how to prevent similar shortages in the future.
I think this is a too many eggs in too few baskets problem.
Right now, Davenport says hospitals will often have one, maybe two suppliers for something like contrast dye. The pandemic has highlighted how risky that can be.
It is going to force the entire medical industry to relook at supply chain and consolidation and understand that they do have to have alternatives.
Dr. James McCarthy is the chief physician executive at Memorial Hermann Health System in Texas.
I've been practicing medicine in Houston for 21 years. And I can tell you for the first at least 18, I never once thought about supply chain.
But after the PPE shortages in the early months of the pandemic, and now this shortage of contrast dye, McCarthy says he thinks about it all the time. Supply chains are now on Aaron Dwyer's mind a lot, too.
You know, people were getting annoyed when it was like toilet paper and you were getting our furniture delivered from West Elm later than normal. You know, that kind of stuff was like, I think, what we all thought of when we first heard supply chain issues. And when it's starting to affect things that keep us healthy or alive is when it really starts to get scary.
It's been almost 6 months since she found out about the growth on her kidney.
And I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know if I should be worried, and I'm trying not to be, but, you know.
Dwyer was supposed to finally get her CT scan this week, but she just got a call from the radiologist's office. Because of the dye shortage, it's been pushed back 6 more weeks to mid-July. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a very rare mention of the British royal family on this program. Saw this on Bloomberg over the weekend. Perhaps you've heard that the Brits are about to celebrate Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee this weekend, including an extra day off for everybody on Thursday. Anyway, Bloomberg figures that that extra bank holiday, as they call it over there, is going to take 0.5 percentage point off second quarter gross domestic product. Seems like a lot. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context cinematic division. That new Tom Cruise film, whatever it's called, I've blanked it out. It shows people are really ready to get back into movie theaters. Bring your own popcorn, though. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal this morning. A quote from the CEO of a company called Preferred Popcorn, which supplies theater chains. Here's what he said, quote, "Popcorn supply will be tight." So there you go. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tim, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.